system. I'd like to particularly welcome Graham Clark. A few years ago, actually, my daughter gave me a second-hand copy of Graham Clark's autobiography, Sounds from Silence, published in 2000. And I must say, I was very deeply moved at many levels by the book. The incredible achievements that he and his team made in the development of the bionic ear, the cochlear implant, and its impact on restoring hearing, or enabling, in fact, first-time hearing for a number of people, even by that time. There were seemingly impossible neurophysiological, surgical, psychophysical, and other technological barriers to be overcome, together with the difficulties of actually getting funding for the project. His care and concern for people suffering from hearing loss was very evident in the book. And there was a radical impact that came out on the cochlear implant made to people's lives. And at the same time, there was also the involvement of his Christian faith throughout his scientific career. Now recently, following the setup in Adelaide earlier this year of the new Graham Clark Research Institute for research and discussions on science and religion, named after Professor Clark, it seemed the most appropriate time to ask him to come and give a lecture to us here, an ISCAS lecture in Sydney. And we were very pleased when he agreed to do so. And of course, here he is in Sydney with his wife, Margaret, too. His achievements, honours, and prizes could take hours to outline and list, and I'm not going to do that now. I will just mention a few very briefly. These include the highly prestigious international scientific awards, such as the 2010 Lister Medal for Surgery, the Zuck Prize from the Max Planck Institute in Germany, the highest award in the neurosciences, the Otto Schmidt Award, the highest accolade in bioengineering from the International Federation for Medical and Biological Engineering. He pioneered the development of audiology in Australia and the essential role of cochlear implantation internationally, and received the A. Charles Holland Foundation International Prize for his contributions in that field. He was given many other awards for his scientific work, including being awarded the Australian Prime Minister's Prize in Science in 2004, made a Fellow of the Australian Academy of Science, and a Fellow of the Royal Society of London, amongst many, many other awards. And he was made a Companion of the Order of Australia in 2004. He has over 1,000 publications, including a textbook on the cochlear implant. It also seems clear to me that the development of the bionic ear has laid a very strong foundation for the development of the bionic eye, though, of course, that is orders of magnitude more complex. But nevertheless, I think the foundation work has been not only incredible in terms of hearing, but also this potential for vision. Now, ISCAST and CASE are both Christian organisations, and it seemed appropriate, particularly given the title of this lecture, to start the evening with a short prayer. So let's do that now. Lord God, those of us who are Christians believe that you are the creator and sustainer of our world, and that you want to communicate and personally relate to us. We thank you that you have revealed much about yourself and your creation in the Bible and in the natural world. We thank you for having graciously created us human beings in your image with the ability to investigate your creation, so that by empirically examining the natural world, we were able to understand its underlying mechanisms. And we thank you that with the scientific knowledge so gained, great potential benefits can be developed for human beings, as we will see exemplified in this lecture. And we thank you for all this in the name of your Son, Jesus Christ. Amen. And let me welcome Graham again.
Deborah and Peter, guests. It's lovely and a great honour to be with you. I want to really share with you, if I may, a personal journey. It's mixed with science and family, and it was heavily influenced at an earlier stage by my Christian contact. But that has been a challenge for me, and I've been always, shall we say, skeptic, never accepting anything on face value. Just let me start at the beginning. My journey started over there, I think, at Scots College, Sydney. I was a boarder, and we went to St. Stephen's Church in Macquarie Street, and we would be sat up at the top, and to fill in the time, we would write rude things in the hymn books, so much so that they had to keep them locked away for all of the other people who might come and read them. But we did have church services on a Sunday, and one of the wonderful, beloved teachers gave us an evening sermon, and he talked about the wonder of his human grandchild that he just had, and that struck a chord, the wonder of human life. That there was, I could see there could be a God behind it. That's as far as my Christian walk went at that stage. When I was a young boy of 10 or 11 years of age, I also had a father who was severely deaf, and he lived in Camden, New South Wales. He was a pharmacist, and people would come into his pharmacy and ask for confidential items, and Dad couldn't hear them very well, and he would say, "Speak up," so all the customers would hear. And in a country town, most people know what everyone's doing, but they certainly knew in Dad's shop. And that was an embarrassment to me too. I wanted to become an ear doctor and help people when I grew up. I therefore did medicine at the University of Sydney, and I remember going to a student Christian movement conference in Otford, and we were asked to invite Christ into our lives. And I thought, there can't be harm in that. And I did so, and I had this extraordinary sense of reality and peace. And I said to myself, I've got to find more out about this and see for myself, by studying the scriptures, what it really meant. And so that's how my journey started. I went, there's my father. He is in his shop there, and to give you an idea of the difficulties for him and what it's like to have a hearing problem, I'm going to play you a brief poem by Jonathan Swift, Gulliver's Travel fame, on his own deafness at the loudness that a normal hearing person would experience.
Deaf, giddy, helpless, left alone, to all my friends a burden grown. No more I hear my church's bell than if it rang out for my knell. At thunder now, no more I start than at the rumbling of a cart.
On the other hand, I'll now play you the same that would be like that experienced by someone severely deaf like my father.
Mm-hmm.
I asked Dad many years later, in his 90s, what it had meant to him to have a severe loss, and he got worse and more progressively deaf. And this is what he said.
Do you feel it's been a handicap being deaf, having a hearing problem?
An enormous handicap. It affects your whole life. There's nothing so embarrassing as not being able to hear people properly and having to work and interview people and talk to them. So many people don't respond when you ask them to speak up.
So most people don't really understand the difficulties that a deaf person has. And I did, and I wanted to help. I was also very inspired in my youth by reading the life of Louis Pasteur, for example, Madame Curie, and was really excited about the possibility of doing the sort of research that Louis Pasteur did. Then, at the University of Sydney, I was selected to be a prosector in anatomy. My dissection's still in the museum there. But therefore, I developed too a love for the human body, the function of the body as well. When I went to that student Christian movement conference in Oxford, I was really keen to learn what Christian faith said about truth. And this is what was in my Bible in 1952. And it was interesting that I had underlined John verse 12. Said, "This is my commandment, that ye love one another as I have loved you." And that I have tried to be my guiding principle. From graduating in medicine at Sydney University, there was the hard slog we all experienced in those days of residency in the Royal Prince Alfred Hospital and the Royal North Shore Hospital, and it was exciting to work with Ian Monk, the cardiac surgery, in the pioneering days of developing heart surgery. But it wasn't all too busy to fall in love with Margaret, and Margaret has been an answered prayer, and I thank God for Margaret and her support over 50 years of marriage now. And I would like to add too in research, my priorities have been God, my family, and then research. It's so easy to put it the other way around. But we got married and we went for a honeymoon to the UK. We all went to train in surgery and practice on the Poms. And this was the days of ship travel, and we were seasick most of the trip on our honeymoon. And I promised Margaret that we'd have a honeymoon later. And after getting my Edinburgh Fellowship in Surgery, we were there. She is so near in one of the Irish beehives. And we had the coldest winter I think they'd ever had. And we had a van that's windows didn't shut, and it had to crank it up to start it in the morning. And when I drove it into the hospital park for the doctors, I think they wondered what on earth they had parking there with all these other flying cars. I had my training at the Royal National Throat, Nose and Ear Hospital in London. This is part of that. And this is Morrill McKenzie's hospital, which was the first one developed to pioneer laryngeal surgery. In fact, the interesting story is that he misdiagnosed the Crown Prince of Germany, who was a pacifist, who had a laryngeal cancer, and had he made the right diagnosis, we might have not had a world war. I came back after training as a ship surgeon, because that's all I could afford, and on the shore Savile Line, somewhere in the Mediterranean, I developed the signs and symptoms of acute appendicitis. And having trained at Royal Prince Alfred and taken out numbers of hot appendices, as we call them, I knew you could die even within 48 or less, 8 hours even. And so there I was, I wondered what to do. It was the first time that my, shall we say, more liberal theological understanding came to be tested, and I realized it needed to have more substance to it, and I prayed like I had not done before publicly, and I had been put off the ship in a little Catholic hospital in Portside, and I asked the sister if she would pray for me in their chapel. She did that, and it was amazing in retrospect how things seemed to open up to finally get back to Australia, appendix intact and safe and sound. But God hadn't finished with me, I believe. On the way back, I came back in an ordinary liner, and I came back, and every day I was there with a Christian missionary doctor, Bill Horse, on his way to Borneo Evangelical Mission, and we had Bible studies every night, and I couldn't avoid it, and I came to realize that the Bible was a really effective and a meaningful and a great testimony of the nature and love of God. We arrived back, we had our first child, and I immediately started working on one of my passions, which is not well known, but I was also training to be a nose surgeon to make noses breathe better and look beautiful, and I started this work at Monash University when it was just forming, and I was keen to see what the stresses and strains are in the bones when you take parts of them out, and I was poor and all I could afford was some kitchen weights and a kitchen balance. And I say that because you don't have to have sophisticated equipment to do research. And I discovered there is a special part of the nose that's important for supporting it, otherwise it'll collapse when you operate on someone's nose. And that applies particularly if you're taking a hump out. But I got tired of only fixing noses and also helping taking out hundreds and hundreds of tonsils. It was having a bad effect on my neck. I don't know whether you realize ENT doctors spend more time looking up nooks and crannies than any other specialties. and a high up injury was being affected. And I prayed to God for healing. And I didn't get healing. I didn't have an answer to my prayers for healing of my neck so I could continue my nose surgery. But I did have an answer. I had an opportunity to go and work with my mentor, Professor Peter Bishop, Professor of Physiology at University of Sydney, one of the pioneers in this country of neurophysiology. And Peter accepted me, and I decided I'd go and learn how the brain functions with electrical stimulation. I also asked Sir John Eccles what his advice would be. At this stage I was 32, and I wrote to Sir John Eccles, who's our Nobel laureate in neurophysiology, and his advice was, don't do it. You're too old. And I was telling his daughter some years later, when I was having dinner with her, about her father's advice to me, and she said, I would quite agree with you. I never do what my father tells me. So it was nice that he thought I was too old. But in his book, he says, the most marvelous theme of the evolutionary story is the development of the nervous system. But each of us, in a sense, has a conscious experience as a spiritual being apart from this world. So he was a Christian, and his words and his advice was ultimately very influential. But I had to go and do something to help my neck, and I had Peter Bishop saying, come. So we left practice in Melbourne with our two daughters now, and it was a matter of faith because we had little money, and being a poor research student, doing a PhD was not a very happy challenge, but I went back to the University Department of Physiology at Sydney and had to learn about electrical engineering and electronics and neurophysiology and so on. And I also did two degrees at the one time. I did a Master of Surgery degree on how the bones support the nose and looked at the stress strain of that. And I also did a PhD. The Master of Surgery degree was quite involved, but there is the thesis at the College of Surgeons in London. But the idea of doing research to look at whether electrical stimulation could actually give you hearing was quite contrary to the idea believed by most physiologists of the day. And there is a comment published by Dr. Merle Lawrence, a leading auditory neurophysiologist, who said direct stimulation of the auditory nerve fibers with resultant perception of speech is not feasible. Now, that was typical of the scientific community, and it was not an unreasonable conclusion, but it didn't really help me in trying to get funds or to pursue the work. And in fact, the whole department had this same view, as did most colleagues around the world. Just to briefly tell you the challenges, here is the outer middle and inner ear. For those of you who are not familiar with the function, this is the outer ear, the middle ear, and the inner ear leading to the brain, and that was the challenge, how to actually stimulate these nerves so that someone could hear speech. The inner ear is arranged in a spatial way, a little like a piano keyboard. Stimulate one part, you get a high frequency, and stimulate the other part, you get a low frequency. There's also a means in the brain of counting the times the nerves fire, whether they fire in time with the sound. So if, for example, you hear a sound of 500 hertz, the sound waves, or the sound of the brain cells, tend to fire in time. Not quite specifically as simple as that. But in the study that I did, I tried to see if the timing would be enough to convey speech frequencies. That would have been a great answer, because that would have meant a cochlear implant could have been a very simple device to put in the ear to stimulate in time with the sound. And in fact, an American surgeon was actually starting to do that work that way, but it didn't convey the important frequencies needed for speech understanding, which are a lot higher than the brain could cope with electrical stimulation. So that was one of my challenges when I worked at Sydney University with the late Professor Colin Dunlop, and some of you may even know today Angela Dalhunty, who was a young BSc student in our lab at the time. But one finding was that if you stimulate the cat's brain electrically, the nerves will fire in time at one pulse per second, and they fall off rapidly at 300 pulses per second, which is what I said, far less than we need for speech understanding. So the answer to me was we should use what's called place coding to try to give people speech understanding. And this just illustrates place coding. One part of the inner ear, the cochlea, is linked to the brain for low pitches, and the other for middle to high pitches. So the question then was, at the end of my PhD, could we stimulate different parts of the cochlea for different speech frequencies and give people speech understanding, so that we'd have an arrangement like that, a speech processor picking up sound from speech, and preferably sending it through the skin by radio waves to a cochlear implant and stimulating the brain on a place coding basis. But that was the end of my PhD, and I had nowhere to go. No one would give me a job after my PhD because they all said it wouldn't work. That included even applying to a surgical position at Brisbane. But in the end, an answer did come, and I must distress, I prayed, but not for a specific result, but that God would guide one in the direction that one took. And this was answered because the University of Melbourne was advertising the first chair of otolaryngology in the whole country, and I applied at the age of just 33 or 34, and this was what I had said. I didn't know whether to be frank and honest, but I decided one had to be. That was one's Christian responsibility, and I said the surgical treatment of perceptive deafness is one in which most advances in otolaryngological otological surgery in the next 10 to 20 years are likely to be made. And as it turned out, that was quite prophetic. But I did get the position, much to my surprise, being only the youngest clinical professor probably in the country at the time. But that's the department that I received. It was the Eye and Ear Hospital ground zero, and the laboratory was the mortuary at the Eye and Ear Hospital, and in an Eye and Ear Hospital it's not used a lot, so that was where I had to start my research. Many of you will not realise that when you do enter these sorts of areas, you get a lots and lots of criticism. And I will not dwell on that, but let me say it was very intense and very hard and hurtful to take. But I prayed for guidance, because research is about managing two people. And I got an answer. I tell you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you. And I got a sense of peace to how to cope with the intense and hurtful criticisms. Now this is back still just starting. This is an interview and will give you an idea of what things were like. When 3 years after I started, this was a press interview with me about what I was hoping to do with this research.
How far out was the time you were going to take?
Well, I hope we will be able to apply this within a few years. One very important area that needs developing is the receiver and the transmitter that can actually apply these electrostimuli to patients. We believe it will be successful because we've been carrying out a series of experiments on animals. We have implanted these electrodes to see whether they are well tolerated for long periods of time. And we have also carried out experiments to see whether the different aspects of electrical stimuli can reproduce sound.
One of the criticisms I received was, even after 3 years in the chair, was that the university had appointed a cat doctor, not a proper doctor at all. And a delegation was even made to the Vice Chancellor, hinting and suggesting that this new professor should be asked to take early retirement. But that was just an indication of the pressure that one received. This then is another television recording. Fortunately, there were good people who were supportive, and one was Sir Reginald Ansett, the Channel O of Channel O at the time, and he had Hector Crawford, who some of you may remember from the days of the box and what have you. He had him make a promotional film called Living in Silence. This is 1973.
In children and adults with severe nerve deafness, there's a possibility that we may soon be able to use some of the latest developments in electronics to stimulate the hearing nerve electrically. In this man, who will say, for example, was voluntarily deaf, it may eventually be possible to implant a number of very small electrodes connected to a radio receiver underneath the skin close to the hearing nerve. He would have a miniaturized computer and radio transmitter, not yet developed, but looking something like this. When someone spoke,
I don't think it's very outside.
Their voice would be converted into electrical energy and beamed to the radio receiver to stimulate the hearing nerve in an appropriate way.
Please make your donation payable to the University of Melbourne and address your envelope to the Nerve Deafness Fund, Post Office Box 155, Number 1, 3131. All donations of $2 or more are tax deductible.
So we'd accept anything. But to get the next stage done was going to cost some few hundred thousand dollars to pay for the electronics. Up to that time, I had gone to Rotary and Lions and Apex clubs and spoken at fundraising luncheons, and I'd get $100 for this and $100 for that, and I could see that it was going to take a lot of luncheons to get the necessary money, and not being a slight build, it wasn't a problem then, but I had help from again going to scriptures, and I was taken by this verse, pray without ceasing. And Margaret will tell you that it was a matter of praying. And again I stress, not praying for this amount of money or that amount of money, but praying that God's will would be done. I'd accept it either way. But there is Sir Reginald Ansett, and he was very supportive, as was the whole channel station, but not entirely, because we had to work to spend our time also raising funds to help the telephone, and I suppose it was about 50% of my time was spent in fundraising when I would have loved to have been right there working hard in the lab. And we would have permission every week to go down the streets of Melbourne to shake a tin. I had a competition with my PA as to who could raise the most money. She stood outside George's, which is the fashionable shop in Melbourne, and I stood in Swanson Street catching all the older ladies coming back from Myers. Guess who won? I did. This was the challenge then, to make a device that could be safely placed in a person and tested out. At the time, you may not realize this, the transistor or the chip, silicon chip, was just becoming available. Had we used valves, that wouldn't have really worked. The transistor might have done some simple things, as illustrated here, but it wasn't till the chip became developed that we could really establish whether this would work. And there you see that yellow disc has a tiny little dot on it, and that is a silicon chip of the day, having about 400 of radio valves on it, so it was obviously possible to design something. Two of our engineers designed the chip. This is the first chip. That, by modern standards, is very simple. Silicon chips today have far more electronics on them than that, but that was good enough. And there were three substrates put in the gold box, as we call it. These are the silicon chips, and the electronic circuitry has been joined up by photolithography. There was nowhere in Australia to do any of this work, really, at the time. And so one had to go here, there and everywhere. Fortunately, Telstra did have equipment. Telstra wasn't tied to production schedules, and they had for a time, and they helped design this circuitry. While that was going on, I realised that I would have to also learn how to code speech. It was a case of learning how to do lots of different things. I'd love to have got special interest in one or other, but this meant going to the late Professor Donald Mackay's lab in Kiel, in UK. And there is Donald Mackay with one of his visitors. Donald Mackay is a real icon when it comes to faith and science. And he's written so much powerful stuff on the mind and brain science. He was, in my opinion, a genius. Coming back from that study, the next challenge was to put wires, 20 odd little wires, around the tiny spiral of the inner ear. That spiral has got a diameter of 1.2 millimetres. How could we get 22 wires to go around this tiny spiral, which you see there? And they didn't. They got stuck. And without that, I couldn't have taken the electronics to the next stage to help people. So, again, it was a matter of prayer and just fortunate circumstances, whichever you like to look at it. And while holidaying at Minamurra, near our house in Kiama, I was playing around with shells and grass blades when I was supposed to be watching the children surfing. And I found that if the blades were bendable at the tip, it's not a really powerful concept, but it wasn't clear at the time, if they bend progressively from the tip to the base is stiff enough to force the electrode around the spiral, and that's really the basis of all cochlear implant electrodes to the day. We're working, the biologists, working with the engineers, and it's been a team effort, developed our first implant with aerials to take power to make it work instead of batteries like pacemakers, and to also take data to control it. Now that had all of that electronics that I showed you before. It had the equivalent of 6,000 transistors in it. It became the most complex package of electronics ever put in a person, with all the hazards and the risks of doing that, done by the University of Melbourne, you might say as a cottage industry. And on the 1st of August 1978, I had to then turn into surgeon again, and with my colleague Brian Pyman, we implanted that device into our first patient, and this is for you, no blood, just the last few minutes of that very first operation on Rod Saunders.
The electronic package attached to the electrode bundle is then correctly positioned in the bed excavated in the bone. Finally, it is covered with tissue in layers and the skin incision sutured.
Rod recovered from that. I won't tell you all the hiccups we had, but at the time it was rumoured amongst the medical community in Melbourne in particular that by doing this operation in 1978 I would kill my patient. Not a great thought also for doing something for the first time. And so you can imagine my feeling 5 days after that operation on Rod, when there was a code blue in the hospital, and for those of you who are not used to hospital systems, that means there's a medical emergency. I had this sort of premonition that it might have been Rod. I rang the switchboard. It was on the floor where my patient was. I flew up those stairs like Usain Bolt, and it was Rod. He had collapsed. But fortunately, I knew, as an ENT surgeon too, that he'd fainted, because I knew that every time I went previously to wash someone's sinus out, young healthy boys in particular, with a big long needle, they'd all faint. So I knew that Rod had fainted, and so all was well. But that was not the end of the story. We had operated, he had recovered, he was healing up well. Could he even hear anything at all with the implant? And this is the first recording made on Rod in 1978. He was played a melody on one of his electrodes.
You play that and I'll sing. Sing Matilda, well, sing Matilda, you'll come all, sing Matilda with me.
Now Rod was singing Waltzing Matilda, because prior to that we played him God Save the Queen. And in those days, some of you may remember, you were meant to stand up. So Rod stood up, pulled all the leads out of his equipment, and so we have no recording. So we then played him Waltzing Matilda, and then that's but it was confirmation, very exciting confirmation, that at least it worked and at least he heard rhythm and melodies, but still we had to give him speech understanding. That came later with more detailed studies, which I don't have all there, but it did give him, we worked out how to process the speech so he could understand speech by putting in the high frequencies on a place coding basis as well as the melodies on a rate basis. had then to show that industry, that it was not just a one-off thing for some unique thing we discovered for one patient. In those days, and as now, it was essential to see if things were commercially relevant, and this applied to us, and I had therefore in 1979 to pick a second person to have the implant to see what would happen with the strategy, and as you'll see here, it worked as I didn't really quite believe. And here is Lois, the audiologist, presenting to George now at his second test session, a reading from the newspaper.
This is George, who is listening today for the second time ever to the speech processor. He had the operation just last month. And George has been deaf for 17 years, and he hasn't heard a sound in all that time. Victorian resident medical officers.
Victorian medical officers
will strike from Sunday.
Will strike on Sunday.
Unless the Victorian Hospitals Association.
The Victorian Hospital Association.
Withdraws a plan to cut doctors' wages.
So nothing has changed, but that was back in 1979. But it was not only very satisfying to go to industry and say it works for other people, but it also worked after many years. And that was interesting to me physiologically, that in the brain, the speech processing that had been there prior to his going deaf was still there in the brain cells when stimulated electrically. Just that's by the by, but so much of this for me has been a journey to help people hear speech but also learn how the brain operates. That was fine, but industry was still not prepared to take it up unless we could show that it would be made in a form that would be commercially viable. And that meant we had to take a large bank of computer processing and make it something that could be worn. We were fortunate that at that stage an engineer who had worked in the car industry joined us, Peter Seligman, and he worked on brakes and he was able to cut corners and develop the electronics that made it possible to show that this was now possible. And here is Rod, as soon as we had that working, here is Rod in his home kitchen with the speech processor now the size of a binocular case, the smallest that had been achieved at that stage, talking with his wife.
What time are we going to shop?
What time are we going shopping off? When I do my work. You can help me do the work, and I'll get done quicker.
I'm not
going to do it all right. Can you help me?
No, I'm not going to.
You're not?
I'm going to find out.
Oh, you can have a rest then. You work hard every day, you tell me?
I do, yeah.
Oh,
I've driven 12 miles in about 6 weeks.
What, just going in and out to the hospital?
That's right.
Oh, well, that's very good.
Thank you.
I shan't comment. But that was exciting. That was progress. But George's device failed before we had all of it developed by industry or could get industry involved. This was back in 79. And again, I was pretty down. I've been down, but not out. And I again felt guidance, help through the word, because in Isaiah, God said, a bruised reed it will not break, and a smouldering wick it will not snuff out. I just happened to find that, and it had special meaning, that we weren't to give up. And that was fortunate, because at the time the government was looking for grants to give for research that could be developed industrially, and Ian McPhee had been the minister who funded this initiative firstly. Both sides of Parliament have been helpful. Barry Jones, John Button, and so on. But this is how it started, and this is in 1982. I was on the selection committee for the commercial development, and it was given to Telectronics, who made pacemakers, because they knew how to put things in the body and have them not fail. And there is the first nucleus device with the electronics in this little titanium capsule now, the speech processor here, but still a headband to hold it in place. And that was on that was implanted in our first patient in mid-September, 14th of September, 1982. And I should just pause for a moment and say that is 30 years since that operation, and in a few weeks' time we're going to have a big celebration, and with Graham Carrick, the first patient. These were the first patients I had to select to have that new industrially developed implant. And Graham Carrick the first was here, and George, who was needing replacement, is there, and these were the other people in that study, just to see if we had been able to achieve what was done by the university. And here is a very brief clip of the operation, just to make it clear. That electrode is shown there, and there is the nucleus device and stitching up the wound. Now, Graham Carrick was the first, and I think you might see him in a little while. We had to find out if it worked on Graham. And there is Graham with our audiologist, Richard Dow. And this had to be positioned so he could get the signal. And this is that first test session on Graham Carrick.
Yeah.
That's the sort of feeling people get when they hear again. It is so moving, so dramatic, and it's been something that we have felt honoured, privileged to be part of. But that was still necessary to find a ways of giving him speech, and this is Graham again a little later, having got the speech processor working, and here he is.
And my wife was on the phone speaking to my mother, and I thought to myself, why not have a go? So I said to my wife, do you mind if I speak to mum? Let's try it out. So I took the phone off my wife and I held up against the speech processor in the ear, and I said, hello mum. And I heard a voice, then I heard mum say, how are you, son? And I said, fine, mum. I was surprised myself because I heard her say that. I was sure. But to make sure, I said to mum, count to 1, 2, 3, 4. And she said, all right then. So she counted 1, 2, 3, 4. I heard that coming. Yeah.
Not only did it help for our language, we had to show also did it work for other languages. Especially did it work for tonal languages like Mandarin. And here is one of our, this is the first, to my knowledge, the first Mandarin speaker who had that implant.
Speech processor without depleting. Yeah, good.
林校长，林校长，把头伸了过来，把头分望过来，喊着说，喊着说，喊着说，一枚，一枚，要写信吗？要写信来。
I can't speak for the Mandarin, but when I showed that at a conference we organised, I remember American said, ah, I've got the answer. Everyone needs to learn Mandarin. But it was exciting. And in fact, 10,000 people in China have had the cochlear implant now. And it certainly is making a big difference to the life of people in China. As you've noticed probably, the headband was still being used to keep the transmitting coil in place to send the radio signals through the skin. But that wouldn't have worked for children. Having shown that it worked for adults, the challenge in 1985 was how to help children born deaf. Would children who'd never heard before still be able to get the right speech patterns? Was their brains frozen? Would their brains be able to pick up the code and understand speech? So the first thing that we had to do was to put a magnet in the coil. There's the coil now and the electronics in the capsule. And that didn't have a headband. Now, I bring just the Christian element in it. That magnet is really the innovation and idea of an American Christian physiologist in Texas who got the idea from a fridge magnet. So that is how it was developed for children, with the magnets outside, the magnets inside, and after much testing, much approval, in 1990, it was approved by the US Food and Drug Administration as safe and effective for children from 2 years of age and above. There was much more to share. There's not time enough to tell you about 42 years of research, of which I've just highlighted some important aspects. But children have been one of the highlights of my life, and they still bring tears to my eyes. We learned that if we operated on children who are even younger than 2 years of age, they can develop age equivalent or sometimes even better speech than people, young boys and girls, who have good hearing. Here is a short video clip of a young boy. He was deafened in his early years and implanted at the age of 2, I think, and here he is growing up now.
What actually happened in your case when you switched it on?
That was, has got to be one of the most positive experiences in my life. The joy on his face, his reaction was, he threw himself back and he laughed and he kicked the table, and it was obviously very pleasant for him to hear sound. And it got in turn, it was extremely pleasant for us. It just cemented that everything that we had hoped for was there.
You were pioneering a bit.
I was being a mum. I didn't think about pioneering. I was actually just thinking about when I'm gone, how's he going to go? How's he going to get the best out of his life with language and things like that? And considering he was implanted 21 months and he should have been delayed with speech, he's age appropriate, actually he's above age appropriate, and he's in a normal school, he's not in a deaf image school, he's just in a mainstream school, and he's doing extremely well.
What's your best subjects?
Maths, reading, I think PE, art, and other notes.
More children. How's it going to help our community?
He has the ability to do whatever he wants, and he also can give to the community. He can talk to anybody, he can communicate, he can put his opinion forward, he can do anything he wants to do. So when he goes to work, he can pay taxes like anyone else. He won't be on disability support, he won't need interpreters at secondary school. He won't need any of that extra hands-on. He can give that to the community.
What do you think, Isaac, about your impact? Do you think it's good?
Yeah, very good.
Are you glad it was done?
Yes.
That is just a short journey in the development of the cochlear implant, and I just would like shortly to finish by saying that was the journey that was to help deaf people also to learn how the brain responds to electrical signals, to understand how the brain functions. I did sometimes think I was just as interested in understanding brain function as how to use it for helping deaf people. I just mention that in passing because as a Christian one needs to understand the world, the brain. For me, understanding consciousness is the real challenge now. It's not in necessarily in physics or genetics, but in brain function. There's much to be learned about quarks and chaos, and John Polkinghorne, a Christian who's now a minister, a pastor or minister, and who is led to the work that was being done by the recent study of the molecule. Also, I'd like to say, from an evolutionary point of view, I don't wish to dwell on this, but for me, ever since I joined the SCM way back in the 50s, 60s, this was never an issue to relate evolution to my Christian faith. And recently, Francis Collins is a really foremost Christian scientist who is not only led the American team to develop the human genome, but he's now also the head of the US National Institutes of Health, the most prestigious body in medical science in the United States. And Francis Collins, too, is a Christian, and he sees how faith and science and biology work together. He said, and I read, "Everyone who questions how religious faith could be reconciled with scientific knowledge, everyone who fears that modern science attacks the heart of religious faith, everyone interested in an enlightened discussion of a crucial issue of the time should read this book." In conclusion, I would just like to finish by a quote from Isaiah 26, verse 12. And it says, "All that we have accomplished, you have done for us. And my prayer is, Father, what joy it is to be assured that the simplest among us can know your will, and the least gifted may say, God led me, thank you, Father, heal me." Thank you.